When Thomas Jefferson protested to George Washington in September 1792 that he had only remained silent on the first two of Alexander Hamilton's reports, on the public credit and the national bank, because I was duped by the Secretary of the Treasury and made a tool for forwarding his schemes, Jefferson was only partly correct. No one entirely duped Thomas Jefferson, unless Jefferson was willing to be duped. And in this case, he was not only a willing, but a major player in a deal whose ultimate importance turned out to be just as significant as Hamilton's reports. The Constitution may well have said nothing about public credit or banks, but it did say something very specific about the creation of a national capital in Article 1, Section 8. A district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States. This was partly an attempt to silence a squall of demands which had been blowing since the beginning of the Revolution from over 30 different locations for the nod as the national capital. It was also partly a recognition that designating a national capital involved more than merely an agreement to set up the operations of the new federal government in a particular place. The capitals of great nations were symbols of the greatness of those nations. London, Paris, Amsterdam, these were not mere administrative locations. In the case of St. Petersburg, the creation of the Russian capital was a deliberate statement by the Russian Emperor, Peter the Great, of a window on the West, which would turn Russia decisively away from its ingrown past. The capital of the American Republic could hardly be less. The first Congress had only been at work for 4 months before the first proposal was made on August 27, 1789, to select a permanent residence for the general government of the United States. And at once, it sparked a heated debate over the principles of the Union. Selecting a capital, insisted Georgia Representative James Jackson, was important in every view. It might be compared to the heart of the human body. It was the center from which the principles of life were carried to the extremities, and from these it might return again with precision. But that anatomical comparison carried with it the suggestion that such a heart ought to be located at the geographical center of the United States. And that was clearly not where they were presently sitting, in New York City. If that was the issue, objected Fisher Ames, it might be settled in a very short time. Calculate the acres in the United States, along with the oaks and the mountains, and perhaps a few days may settle the business. Ames argued that the national capital should be located closer to where the action is. My opinion is that the center of government ought to be a center of convenience and utility, that the heart should be so placed as to propel the blood to the extremities with the most equable and gentle motion. But when the House of Representatives tried to bring the matter to a vote on September 3rd, the proposal bogged down in a three-way debate among advocates for a capital on the Delaware River, the Potomac River, and, perhaps least likely of all, the Susquehanna River. Not even James Madison could prevail over the tumult, and Madison, disgusted over the furor, testily told his fellow representatives that if a prophet had risen in the Virginia Ratifying Convention and brought the declarations and proceedings of this day into view, I firmly believe Virginia might not have been a part of the Union at this moment. Personally, Madison favored a location on the Potomac. It could only have multiplied his irritation that the House, when it finally resolved the matter on September 7th, voted to locate the capital at some convenient place on the banks of the River Susquehanna in the state of Pennsylvania. And that until the necessary buildings be erected for the purpose, the seat of government ought to continue in the city of New York. Well, Madison was unwilling to take no for an answer, as were his fellow Virginians. "The business of the seat of government has become a labyrinth," he wrote to Edmund Pendleton. "We are endeavoring to keep the pretensions of the Potomac in view, and to give to all the circumstances that occur a turn favorable to it." Madison's fixation on the Potomac was more than just an exercise in Virginian self-importance. Like so much else in the formation of the new government, there was a savvy element of self-interest at work as well. After all, the entire process, which created the Constitution, began with a conference in 1785, which was supposed to resolve commercial issues on the Potomac between Virginia and Maryland. Commercial development of the Potomac was the principal feature in the creation of the Potomac Navigation Company, George Washington's pet project for developing the Potomac River properties and linking them by a system of canals with the Ohio River. There were already two small but neat towns on the Potomac at Alexandria and Georgetown, with good houses, some in rows, others in a line, but detached, the intervals between them not being yet filled up. Planting the national capital along the Potomac would only make the property investments of the Potomac Company more valuable. Washington had invested $12,000 of his own in the Potomac Company, along with another $22,000 which had come his way as a gift of the Virginia legislature. Together, all of it amounted to somewhere around $1 million in modern currency. Madison, Light Horse Harry Lee, Washington's old cavalry chief and now governor of Virginia, former Maryland governor Thomas Johnson, had all invested in the Potomac Company. And Washington eagerly tried to sign up adventurers for the project in France. Men who can afford to lay a little while out of their money, Washington wrote to Lafayette, are laying the foundation of the greatest returns of any speculation I know of in the world. All of this could be more easily placed within the Potomac Company's grasp if Congress could somehow be persuaded to stop debating the issue and settle on a Potomac River site for the federal district. And the mechanism for securing that agreement came to hand in a June evening in 1790. From the time the first Congress reassembled for its second session in January 1790 until June, the subject which consumed virtually all of Congress's time was Hamilton's report on the public credit. It was a harrowing experience for Hamilton, whose look was somber, haggard, and dejected beyond description. Much of that dejection was due to James Madison's resolute opposition to Hamilton's plan, and especially the provision for takeover or assumption of the state debts by the federal treasury. But Madison wanted the Potomac too. And Hamilton had something which he could deliver for Madison, and that was the votes of New York's congressional delegation. So with Jefferson acting as host, Madison and Hamilton met quietly over dinner and cut a deal. Madison would drop his opposition to the takeover of the state debts, and Hamilton would line up his congressional allies behind the Potomac scheme. The dinner ended in Mr. Madison's acquiescence, Jefferson wrote, matched by Hamilton's agreement that the removal of the seat of government to the Potomac was a just measure and would probably be a popular one. Without another word in public, a new bill for locating the capital appeared in the Senate, specifying that a district of territory not exceeding 10 miles square to be located on the River Potomac at some place between the mouths of the Eastern Branch and the Conococheague be accepted for the permanent seat of the government of the United States, and that the federal government would begin business there on the first Monday of December 1800. Three commissioners were to be appointed by the president to act in charge of extinguishing existing land titles, surveying the district, and arranging for its development. In the meanwhile, Philadelphia would become the temporary capital, and the next session of Congress would open there on the first Monday of December 1790. This residence bill passed the Senate on July 1st, 14-12, and then went on to the House. And after 3 furious days of debate, in which Madison was curiously silent, but in which Richard Bland Lee of Virginia alluded delicately to the great object of funding the debts of the United States, the bill passed, squeaking as it went, 32-29. On July 26th, Hamilton's bill for assuming the state debts also squeaked by, 33-27. One hand had washed the other. There was a last-minute surge of discontent from several Southern members, though, led by Adonis Burke of South Carolina. Burke saw no purpose in building a new capital from scratch. He thought a populous city better than building a palace in the woods. But he was not willing to let the capital go to Philadelphia, even for a short while. Because, he added darkly, there were members from that state who, by their political management, had raised a storm in the United States. And Burke was not being coy, because the transcript shows that for this comment, Burke was called to order. Why the kerfluffle? On February 11, 1790, just after the second session of Congress had reconvened, Pennsylvania Congressman Thomas Fitzsimmons, he who had so eagerly carried a copy of the new Constitution into the Pennsylvania Assembly on the day it was signed, presented a petition from the annual general meeting of the Society of Friends, the people called Quakers, who, believing that unfeigned righteousness in public as well as private stations is the only sure ground of hope for the divine blessing, petitioned in their Philadelphia meeting for the abolition of the licentious wickedness of the African trade for slaves and the inhuman tyranny and blood guiltiness inseparable from it. The petition immediately triggered an outburst from slaveholding congressmen, and especially James Jackson of Georgia, who resented the implications of tyranny and licentiousness. Why, there were slaveholders as useful and as good citizens as the petitioners. Men equally friends to the revolution and equally susceptible of the refined sensations of humanity and benevolence. And the Philadelphia Quakers deserved no particular attention for bringing forward a business of questionable policy. This would only become the camel's nose for a total emancipation. Madison struggled to quiet the inflamed tempers of his fellow Southerners, but they got another dose of irritation the next day when a second petition was submitted, which, in fact, did ask Congress to use all justifiable endeavors to loosen the bands of slavery and promote a general enjoyment of the blessings of freedom. This time, though, the petition came from the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, and was signed by its president, no one less than Benjamin Franklin. This provoked William Loudon Smith to complain that a gentleman can hardly come with a servant or two to Philadelphia, but there are persons trying to seduce his servants to leave him. No wonder Adonis Burke could warn that a Quaker state was a bad neighborhood for the South Carolinians. Madison thought the furor had been shamefully indecent, but he might also have reflected that any hesitation on the part of Congress about moving on from Philadelphia once the new capital had been laid out on the Potomac had been pretty effectively wiped clean. It is one of the delicious ironies of the debate over the seat of government that in their eagerness to ensure that the Capitol really did move on to the Potomac and not merely stay put in Philadelphia out of sheer inertia, the Southern members inadvertently, through the work of surveying and laying out the new capital city, into the hands of a free black mathematician, Benjamin Banneker. By stipulating that the new district lie on the Potomac, between the mouths of the Eastern Branch and Conococheague, the residence bill had actually given George Washington and his three commissioners, whom he promptly selected from among the investors in the Potomac Company, a 150-mile stretch of river to use in selecting a site. But Washington had no doubts where he wanted the federal city built, at the Eastern Branch, the Anacostia River, only 15 miles upriver from his own Potomac estate at Mount Vernon. To survey the new district, he turned to Andrew Ellicott, who had completed the survey of the Mason-Dixon line in 1784 and been involved in surveying missions in western Pennsylvania and the Northwest Territory. And Ellicott, in turn, hired Benjamin Banneker as his assistant. Banneker was an unusual man, no matter which way you looked at him. His grandmother, Molly Welch, was from Devon, a female convict laborer sentenced to a 7-year indenture in Maryland. She not only survived her indenture, but managed to buy property on the Patapsco River and eventually bought two black slaves fresh off a slaving ship. One of them, named Banica, she eventually married. Their daughter married a freed slave who took her name as Banneke, and their first son, Benjamin, was born on November 9, 1731. He was noticed from the start as a mathematical prodigy, able to calculate complicated sums in his head and blessed with total recall. He briefly attended an obscure and distant country school, but not until 1787, when the Ellicott family began employing him as a clockmaker, did he begin to show even more astonishing capacities. The Ellicotts fed his curiosity by lending him three books on astronomy, which he effortlessly absorbed and made the great object of his life. He issued an almanac in 1792 with corrections of the astronomy textbooks he had read, and in short order, he found himself a celebrity. Banneker boldly sent a copy of his almanac to Thomas Jefferson, who in turn forwarded it to the Academy of Sciences in Paris as a document to which your whole color had a right for the justification against the doubts which had been entertained of them. No one, of course, had expressed those doubts more loudly than Jefferson himself. And the local Georgetown newspaper took wicked delight in reporting that Banneker's abilities as a surveyor and an astronomer clearly proved that Mr. Jefferson's concluding that race of men were void of mental endowments was without foundation. Banneker's immediate task in February of 1791 was to join a surveying team headed by Andrew Ellicott, but including Pierre L'Enfant, the flamboyant former engineer of the Continental Army, who, perhaps unduly, impressed Washington with his designs and drawings as a scientific man, Isaac Robideau, and William and Nicholas King. The surveyors set up a temporary base in Alexandria on February 7th, and Banneker and Ellicott erected an observation tent and the most important of the team's instruments, a zenith sector, which would be used for determining latitude by the zenith of selected stars, and a transit telescope. Together, Ellicott and Banneker laid out the square of the district, starting at Jones Point on the Potomac, and laying out four angles. with a compass made for him by David Rittenhouse, a compass which, by the way, is part of the Smithsonian's collections and has been since 1884, Ellicott finished walking out the first boundary line by February 23rd, while Banneker checked all sightings by an astronomical regulator. On April 15th, they laid the first stone boundary marker at Jones Point, then began marking the remaining boundary lines through the summer. Banneker's deportment, wrote Andrew Ellicott's niece in 1836, throughout the whole of this engagement, was such as to secure for him the admiration and respect of the commissioners and their staff. His striking superiority over all men of his race whom they had met led them to disregard all prejudice of caste and converse freely with him and enjoy the clearness and originality of his remarks. In the meanwhile, Banneker was taking observations for a new edition of his almanac, using a solar eclipse on April 3rd as a back trial to see how my present method would agree with the former. The next stages of the creation of the federal city would not go nearly so smoothly. Washington's engineer, Pierre L'Enfant, had been commissioned to begin designing the best layout of streets and buildings. What he produced for Washington's inspection on March 28, 1791, was a curious-looking plat of long avenues meeting at unusual angles to form circles, which were themselves in no particular juxtaposition to each other. Compared to the plain and unassuming grid of Philadelphia's streets, L'Enfant's plan looked exotic. But Washington loved it. And L'Enfant went on to select the most desirable position for to erect the public edifices. The principal of these locations was Jenkins Hill, where L'Enfant planned to build the Congress House. A mile due west, L'Enfant would construct the President's Mansion, possessing the sumptuousness of a palace, the convenience of a house, and the agreeableness of a country seat. Connecting the two would be a wide boulevard, the present-day Pennsylvania Avenue. And north of the President's Mansion, L'Enfant proposed to block out 15,000 building lots, which, when auctioned, would provide more than enough revenue for the construction of the city, which, in deference to the president, Congress decreed in September would bear the name Washington, which was a distinct improvement on William Lowton Smith's enthusiasm for calling it Washingtonopolis. This, however, was where the wheels began to come off. The first auction of town lots was scheduled for October 17, 1791. But at the last moment, L'Enfant decided that the auction was a big mistake. The commissioners should borrow the money they needed for L'Enfant's construction projects and hold back the town lots to a later date when their value would have increased still more. And since L'Enfant owned the only copy of his street plan, he made sure to prevent the exhibition of the general plan at the spot where the sale is made. Well, naturally, the auction fizzled. Only 35 lots were sold. And Washington had L'Enfant fired in March 1792. Washington turned next to Samuel Blodgett, a man of much personal charm, who had bought several of the lots at the first auction on October 17th. And who now proposed to Washington to take over management of a second auction in October 1792. Blodgett's auction was no more successful than its predecessor, selling only 70 more lots. In late September 1793, a third sell-off was held, this time under the direction of James Greenleaf, who had made a fortune during the Revolution as an agent for Dutch bankers. Greenleaf's plan was to buy 3,000 lots himself, along with two partners, Then, as these sales nudged the remaining lot prices higher, by another 1,000, then another 1,200, until they had acquired 7,325 town lots. All this would be financed by Greenleaf's Dutch banking friends. And as they bought ever dearer, they would sell the lots they had purchased cheaply at great profits, continuing to drive the profits upwards as they sold more and more lots. But by 1793, the French Revolution had broken out, and with it, war between France and the great European monarchies. Investment capital dried up, especially for American borrowers. By mid-August 1794, Greenleaf and his partners, who had relied on the Dutch, were bankrupt. And to make matters worse, Washington and the commissioners had given the go-ahead for construction to begin on the Capitol building and the president's house. That might not have been cash in the till to pay for the construction, but if the construction was not completed and ready for congressional occupancy by the due date in 1800, the national capital would remain by default in Philadelphia. And all the fine hopes of greatest returns of any speculation would evaporate. Finally, on January 8, 1796, Washington admitted defeat. He addressed a message to Congress, stating with as much dignity as he could muster, that the plans for locating a district for the permanent seat of the government of the United States, which he had hoped could be completed in season without aid from the federal treasury, had met new and arduous difficulties. He now had to submit a request from the commissioners for intervention, a loan from Congress, to the tune of $500,000, to complete the public buildings in the city of Washington. Naturally, the House of Representatives choked, but warned Jeremiah Crabb of Maryland, without the loan, Congress would strongly convey the idea and enforce belief that the general government was not serious, not firmly fixed in their purpose of making the present location the permanent seat of Congress. On March 31st, the House of Representatives, with Fisher Ames, James Madison, and even the truculent William Finley voting yes, approved the loan. By the obstructions continually thrown in its way by friends or enemies, this city has had to pass through a fiery trial, Washington remarked. Yet, I trust it will ultimately escape the ordeal with éclat. And it would, in more ways than Washington could have imagined. And it would rest on a foundation laid not by Washington, but by a black mathematician and his white employer.